Good evening.
K2 Romeo India Whiskey is my call letters. Richard, or Dick, is my name. And Dick, along with Mel, who is K2KEY, are going to start a thing called the Technical Med. For the few people in the New York area who haven't heard of the Technical Med, its major purpose is education. We give information to each other. The clan gathers at this time, and we help each other find out how to get more enjoyment out of this hobby of ham radio. It's a little bit complicated. It's 26 or 27 different kinds of ham radio. We try to discuss quite a few of those. The subjects that are appropriate for the Technical Met are essentially any subject of interest to ham radio operators. Usually electronic, wireless, or radio communication is involved, but not always. There are times we get into some of the technicalities or the fun of high-definition television and tape recorders, all kinds of things. A person signs into the TechNet, and by the way, the subjects that we discuss most of the time are the subjects you guys bring to the net. Once in a while, Mel will have a package of information he wants to give, but most of the time, what we discuss is what you guys ask. So if you're unhappy with the subjects, choose the subject you like, if you know what I mean. A person signs into the Technical Net by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, because I'm so darn forgetful, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. A typical sign-in might be N2NNU, Alex, and yes. So do we have any check-ins? Give me your call letters and name at this time.
Well, if you mention it, me.
John with comment. Okay, I heard Alex and John. John, please give me your call letters one more time.
Kilo, Delta, 2, Bravo, Delta.
Got it that time, John. You're a little bit noisy, but we're going to be able to get good copy out of that. Anything you can do about that would be helpful. Okay, Alex and John, who else would like to check in? Give me your call letters and name at this time.
W2PNJ, Bob, yes.
Bob recognized?
Good evening, all. K2KEY.
Mel recognized. You're a tiny bit noisy tonight, Mel. You're running full power into one of the good antennas on Dover Street.
Maybe a little noisy. Tell you what, I'll go to higher power. See if that helps. Hold on.
Roger, Dodger. You might need it.
Okay. How's this sound?
That is better. You're now 95% quieting, and a pretty good sounding signal. Who else would like to check in? K2RIW listening.
KC2MDP. Steve, no questions.
Steve with a no. Anyone else?
It's unlucky.
Okay, let's start off with Alex. I didn't hear you say yes or no, Alex. You do have a question or a comment? It's all yours. N2NNU. One of those guys from Yonkers. Look out for them. K2RIW.
Yeah, good evening, Nick. Dick. what's wrong with Nick? Good evening, Dick. Good evening, everybody. I hope everybody had a nice holiday and a good day of rest. I don't have a question per se, but perhaps I'm going to contribute with some comments later on. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, and a quick question. I hope you did get that last email I mailed.
Oh yeah, definitely so. It ended up in the spam directory, although it shouldn't have to. I read it. The article is extremely interesting. I'm going to have to digest it a little bit better. Sort of the second part, I agree completely with you, but I have to read it better and to give you a better answer to it. So that's how it goes.
Perfectly acceptable. He's only had it for a short period of time, and I probably mailed him 2,000 words. And everything I mail to Alex goes into his spam file. So I'm the spam to his firewall system. Okay, the next person who signed in was John, Kilo Delta 2 Bravo Delta. What would you like to talk about tonight, John?
Good evening, Dick. Everyone on the net, K2RIW and the TechNet from Kilo Delta 2 Bravo Delta. Just have a bit of information that might be of interest to TechNet folks. And on this Wednesday evening, April 15th, 2009, there will be a frequency measurement test taking place on some HF bands. These are going to be consisting of transmissions from Kilo 5 Charlie Mike in Muskegee, Oklahoma, and Whiskey 6 Oscar Quebec, India, from here to Los Angeles, California. These are going to be some CW and key down transmissions taking place on 40, 80, and potentially 160 meters in the late evening, starting around 10:30. In the past, the AWRL has held frequency measurement tests, and I guess starting about 4 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, Connie Marshall, K5 Charlie Mike, started doing some of his own, and generally, the frequency measurement transmissions that he engages in are generally more accurate than the AWRL sponsored test. K5CM, by the way, was the second person in the world to work all states on 2 meters. He did that quite a number of years ago. So let me see how you're copying, and if your copy is okay, I'll go ahead with some specifics on frequencies and times. K2RAW in the TechNet from KD2BD.
Quite good, John. I see from your website that you're quite involved with everything from low frequency all the way through UHF. You cover the spectrum. You're into packet radio. You're into a whole lot of things. My goodness. If you go to QRZ.com and you look up Kilo Delta 2 Bravo Delta, you'll see that John and Siegert is quite an active guy. After you finish giving us the information, and by the way, your signal is, I'm going to call it 85% quieting. For a person who is a little bit careful in reasoning and listening, he'll have no trouble hearing your information. After your information, I do have a question for you, John. Kilo Delta 2 Bravo Delta, K2RAW.
Okay, very good. K2RAW in the TechNet from Kilo Delta 2 Bravo Delta. Okay, the first transmission from K5CM will take place on 40 meters on 7078 kilohertz. That will take place starting at 10:30 p.m. All these transmissions begin with a 3-minute CW call-up followed by a 3-minute key-down period. So the object is to measure the frequency of the carrier that Connie is transmitting. And on his website, www.k5cm.com, k5charliemike.com, you'll find information on this event and also a web page that will allow you to enter in your entries to submit them so that they can be tabulated with everyone else's, and you'll be able to see how well you match the transmitted frequencies. The 40-meter transmission will be followed on 80 meters on 3578 kilohertz at 10:45 p.m. There's a possibility he might also do a run on 160 meters. If so, that would take place on or about 1845 kilohertz at 11 p.m. This will be followed by Marvin, W6, Oscar Quebec, India, on 40 meters on 7067 kilohertz. That'll begin at 11:30 p.m. local time. And that'll be followed by an 80-meter transmission on 3567 kilohertz at 11:45 p.m. I've been participating in these for, I guess, about the past 4 or 5 years or so. Very fascinating to see the entries come in and to see different effects that people see on propagation of these signals get to various parts of the country. I think some of my best results were just a few months ago. In January, there was a frequency measurement test that took place. I copied the K5CM on 160 meters with about an error of 7 parts per billion, and on 80 meters, 5 parts per billion error. That's kind of rare because propagation has a lot to do with how accurately an individual can measure a carrier on HF. So back to you, Dick. K2RAW in the TechNet from KD2B.
Wow, you've answered my question. I was about to ask you, with the current state-of-the-art of frequency measuring in a real world where ionospheric propagation is taking place and that ionosphere is a plasma media that is always under some kind of motion by my standards, and therefore you're getting a kind of Doppler shift. If I change the distance between me and the transmitter, and if I was approaching the transmitter, the laws of Doppler shifting say that I will measure a frequency higher than reality. And correspondingly, if I recede away from a transmitter, I'll measure a frequency lower than reality. You could say there's a certain number of cycles in the pipe. I'm using the word pipe as the medium that exists between the transmitter and the receiver. There's a certain number of cycles in that pipe, and those cycles are moving at a certain rate, which happens to be the speed of light. And as you traverse up the pipe toward the transmitter, you encounter those cycles faster than you would if you sat still and wait for those cycles to come by you as you sit there on the side of the pipe, if you know what I mean. Okay? That pipe is, in some cases, a bent pipe, where the signal is coming out of the transmitting antenna, going up to the ionosphere, coming back down, bouncing off the Earth, going back up maybe one more time, we'll say, hitting the ionosphere, and then coming into your receiving site. So that bent pipe now has a particular length which moves as the ionosphere, or the point of apparent reflection. And the word apparent is mean in two ways here. There's no real point of reflection, it's a whole field of reflection. But still, the apparent point of reflection can be going up or down in altitude, and therefore the total length of the zigzag path is increasing or decreasing, very similar to what happens when you walk up the pipe or walk down the pipe, so to speak. So therefore you measure a frequency higher or lower, and 7 parts per billion strikes me as very significant. That's 1 part in 10 to the 9. I believe the frequency accuracy of the best frequency standards, the cesium beam standards used by the National Bureau of Standards, as it used to be called, NIST is what it's called now, Institute of, not Science and Technology, I keep forgetting what NIST stands for, but that particular group,
repeater, timeout.
I believe they can measure frequency to 1 part in 10 to the 14. So 1 part in 10 to the 9 that you're able to measure, or 8 part in 10 to the 9, some number of parts in 10 to the 9, is getting pretty darn close. I'm wondering also, John, what you use as a standard. Is your standard disciplined by way of a global positioning satellite system? That's one way. A few buddies of mine have experimented from time to time by listening to a geosynchronous satellite and listening to the chrominance subcarrier of a video transmission, the 3.579545 megacycles of the chrominance subcarrier of standard broadcast old-fashioned NTSC television. That particular carrier for a networked program is essentially synchronous with the National Bureau of Standards. So it is a kind of a standard. It's more than a secondary standard, but it's not quite a primary standard in my mind. So I'm kind of curious what means you use to maintain and the accuracy of your particular frequency reference. And I am also curious, like say for instance on 80 meters, what's the nature of the receiver that you use to make those measurements with that accuracy, John? KD2BD, to discuss any of the above, it's your choice. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Very fine, K2RIW in the TechNet from KD2BD. All the equipment I use to exercise is homebrew. Completely built from scratch. My frequency standard is a standard that's based on reception of radio station WWBB at 60 kHz. I have a loop antenna, which is a 40-turn loop. I'm in the attic. It contains probably close to 700 feet of wire that is sharply resonant at 60 kHz. That feeds a analyze devices, instrumentation amplifier, and then after that a frequency selective amplifier mounted right at the antenna. I feed DC operating voltage up to that preamp, and the amplified signal comes down the same length of coax into the remainder of the receiver, which is kind of a super heterodyne type of receiver. There's a single crystal oscillator, which is a 10 megahertz temperature compensated voltage controlled oscillator. That 10 megahertz crystal signal is divided down through a sequence of binary counters, decade counters, and I take a 50 kilohertz output from one of those counters and I mix it with the 60 kilohertz WWBB carrier, and I end up with a 10 kilohertz IF. So 10 kilohertz IF is amplified through a 3 op amp can't think of the name right now, amplifier, very high gain, bi-quad amplifier, that's what it is. And a 10 kilohertz signal is then mixed with a 10 kilohertz derivative of the 10 gigahertz oscillator, in which case at this point I'm converting down to baseband, down to DC. And I have two mixes at that stage, and I and Q, in phase and quadrature mixers. The quadrature mixer output is sent to a low pass filter and then produces an error which is sent back to the 10 megahertz oscillator, which drives it exactly to 10 megahertz. The in-phase detector goes to a separate low-pass filter, and at that point I'm able to strip off WWBB's modulation and decode that with the PIC microcontroller, and then over a period of a minute figure out what time it is, what date it is, and things like that. And that feeds an LCD display which shows the date and the time and things like that. It also drives a phase signature compensation circuit. Getting a little technical now, but the PCB's carrier phase changes. It shifts 45 degrees at 10 minutes after the hour and shifts back to normal phase at 15 minutes after the hour. So this little circuit figures out what time it is and compensates for the phase shift in the carrier, and so doing, maintains the crystal oscillator at the exact operating frequency. Receiver, I'll get to in a second, and frequency count, I'll get to in a second, but let me pass it back to you. K2RW in the TechNet from KD2BD.
I'm giving a nice long delay in case someone else wants to join us on the IRLP or any of the other modes from outside of the area. Interesting, John. I see that your main frequency reference, after all of the hardware and the vector demodulator, the INQ demodulator, I call that a vector demodulator, and the advantage of a vector demodulator, a little bit like a phase lock loop, it's capable of knowing not only a frequency error or a phase error, but it can easily detect whether or not the error is an increase or a decrease in phase or frequency. I am curious as to what is the time constant with which you create the error voltage of your, I'm going to call it a TCXO, a temperature-compensated voltage-controlled oscillator, crystal-controlled voltage-controlled oscillator, where you've got a minor amount of voltage control of your 10 megacycle reference. But that error voltage you feed into it, you want to integrate it significantly. And I'm going to guess that that integration time constant is some significant number of minutes, if not hours, so that any minor perturbations to the 60 kilohertz propagation between you and the NBS is essentially integrated out. So what time constant did you set in there? I am also kind of curious as to how reliable is the 60 kilohertz signal being picked up by your 40-turn loop that resonates at 60 kilohertz. Is that signal giving you, let me pick a number, a 10 decibel signal-to-noise ratio most of the time, and is it there 98% of the time? I'm kind of curious about what reception in Seagirt, New Jersey is like for a 60 kilohertz signal coming from Boulder, Colorado. Discuss any of the above or whatever else you'd like to tell us. It's a fascinating field. I am guessing you're an electronic engineer with lots of years of experience, John, or at least somebody that's really enthusiastic about this particular project, high accuracy frequency measurement. And if need be, I can discuss some of the ways in which this has been used in the past with rather sophisticated military hardware in something that's called phase metering. But we won't get into that right away. Kilo Delta 2, Bravo Delta, for any of the above.
Repeater, timeout.
Kilo Delta 2, Bravo Delta, for any of the above. K2RIW, listening.
Very good. K2RIW and the TechNet from KD2BD. My time constant that drives the crystal oscillator is probably around 30 seconds or so. Not as long as you might think it might be. A couple of reasons for that. One, the time constant I chose was essentially dictated by the size of the capacitors and the size of the resistors that were fairly standard value components. I needed very low leakage capacitors, and I think I'm using, I forgot, actually I so that's the proper terminology for the capacitors. But they're pretty high quality capacitors, and they are under 1 microfarad, about, I think, 0.47 microfarads. And the resistors that are used are in the several mega ohm range. And this forms a, this goes around an op-amp which forms a second, I think it's a second order low-pass filter with a pencil function grow-off. The filter that, and by the way, that yields a bandpass of a couple of millihertz, maybe even a fraction of a millihertz, I'm not even sure at this point. So, the reason, another reason why I don't have that time cut so long is because it would take forever for receiver to lock on the circuit. This, you know, this is a phase lock loop circuit, and the gain has to be just right in the loop, and the phase delay has to be just right. Because I've tried this with a four pole filter, and I can say I believe that the filtering would have been better with a four pole filter, but it takes so long for it to lock up, and then there's overshoot as the phase error coming from the modulator is telling the oscillator to shift up, because it needs to go higher. By the time it happens, you know, a lot of time has passed, and the crystal oscillator at this point is pushed too far off frequency, then it has to come all the way back down again. And you get this very slow oscillation that has to be damped out. By the time you damp that out, you don't really have that much of a integration in that filter. So, another thing is you have to worry about the turn-on characteristics of the oscillator. When you turn it on, it's going to warm up a little bit, and it's going to drift a little bit. So, that phase, that filter has to be big enough to compensate or to be able to handle small-term drift in the oscillator and not go out of lock at it with something like that. The signal itself is fairly stable. Let me just break it for a second.
Amateur television repeater he maintains in Lincroft, New Jersey.
And one of the things he uses that repeater for is to transmit NASA Select Television during space shuttle shots and things like this, and meet up with the International Space Station. You're heavily involved in technology, I can tell, John. Also, I might suggest, John, that your signal is a little bit noisy into the machine. So in future weeks, we're going to want to hear more about this. Anything you can do to slightly increase the signal strength toward this particular repeater, maybe by going through the internet connection, which can be frustrating. It's not a cure-all, but that would be helpful. One of the disadvantages you're working against is that I believe the antenna pattern on this particular repeater, it does have an intentional notch aimed in the direction of Frenchtown, New Jersey, because there is an equal frequency repeater on 146.85 in Frenchtown, so as to minimize the co-channel interference with the fellows in Frenchtown. They've created a notch, and so I think that's part of what you're fighting, if you know what I mean. So if there was a way that you would give us a little bit more signal strength, antenna gain, or whatever in future weeks, that would be helpful. I'm wearing earphones. I have no trouble hearing what you're saying, but I know that some of the people are probably putting their ear a little bit closer to their loudspeaker because of the signal-to-noise ratio. Mel, I wonder if you and the group at the Kings County Radio Club have ever done exact frequency measurements like this. K2KEY, with your comments and questions. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yes, this is K2KEY. Years ago, I used to get involved many times with the ARRL frequency measuring test. Now, this is going back a good number of years ago. And my standard here was a BC221, which was really a World War II standard that was used, frequency meter, World War II version, that I basically did some updating on, you know, as the years went by and technology, of course, became more available. The point I wanted to know, John, did you ever measure, for instance, WWV at 5 or 10 megahertz? And what was your conclusion? Because I'd like to know, what is WWV at 5 or 10 or 15 megahertz? What is there, in other words, what can you expect as far as when making the frequency test on them? And what is the precise accuracy do you believe that they are transmitting? Dick, I guess you can comment also on that. I'll turn it back to you first, Dick. Over.
Yeah, I noticed I own a receiver that can listen to 2.5, 5, 10, and 15 megacycles. And it's got its own little whip antenna on it. And there's a significant number of hours, particularly during the daytime, in which I get no reception. So I am guessing the higher frequencies could, in theory, give you a little bit more accuracy in a shorter period of time, but the signal itself doesn't have anywhere near the reliability of the 60 kilohertz signal from WWVB. That is a guess on my part. And John, let's see if you can confirm or deny all that. KD2VD, K2RIW in the TechNet group.
Very good. K2RIW in the TechNet from KD2VD. Yes, WWVB on 60 kilohertz travels through ground waves and D-layer refraction. And the D-layer is very stable. And contrary to what we published, the D-layer does not disappear at night. Its effect as an attenuator to HF signals pretty much goes away after sunset. But cosmic radiation and background radiation maintain the D-layer ionization, and it's just enough to enable LF signals to propagate through fairly long distance. WWVB and CHU, of course, propagate through E-layer maybe during the day and F-layer at night. The F-layer is very volatile, and I have not monitored CHU. I've monitored at 3.33 megahertz and WWV at 5 megahertz for example, 3 or 4 hours at a clip, and I've plotted my frequency measurements, and something really fascinating happens. One of the last times I plotted WWVB's reception at 5 megahertz, during the 3 or 4 hour reception period, not once did I measure it to be exactly 5 megahertz. It was always a little high, it was always a little low, and there's this cyclic pattern that occurs if I plot frequency over time. It's as if the Doppler shift is acting in such a way that there's this, maybe about a 30-minute cyclicity in the Doppler shift. So if you're really lucky and you just pick the right time, you'll get it really accurate. But most of the time, it's either going to be a little bit high or a little bit low. And as far as how much, how high or high low, that varies. It's, you know, with a fraction of a hertz, sometimes a little bit more than that. Sometimes it's, you know, if the ionosphere is unstable, it could be, you know, a hertz or more. Right now, we have a very low solar activity, which makes things very stable, and it's an excellent time to make any frequency measurements, because your accuracy can be quite high due to the low sunspot number and the low and the quiet geomagnetic field. KQRAW in the TechNet from KD2BD.
Okay. See if I got my mathematics right here. If I'm listening to a 5 megahertz signal, and because of ionospheric shifting of its apparent altitude, apparent point of reflection, or whatever, I get 1 hertz of increase or decrease in the apparent frequency, that is approximately 200 parts per billion, if I get the math right. And you're making measurements by way of your standard frequency reference at 10 megacycle and using the 60 kilohertz signal. You're getting down to an overall accuracy of what you said was 7 parts per billion. So you're doing almost 2 orders of magnitude better by using 60 kilohertz as opposed to using 5 megahertz for short-term measurements. Now, because that cyclicity of the apparent frequency at 5 megacycles is moving up and down over some number of, hours or so, you could, in theory, use a longer integration time. But now, as you started telling us before, you really have a Bode plot problem. In other words, a servo mechanism, stability. Whenever a person builds a feedback network that tries to control some position, frequency, rate, whatever, the phase shift between the error signal and the final movement of whatever is being controlled has to be carefully controlled. Otherwise, you can go into a system, servo system oscillation. Some people call that stability analysis. There's many ways, but the Bode plot was the one that I measured. I remember the most from all the techniques I was taught in college. So establishing a stable Bode plot is one heck of a problem. And if I understand you correctly, you found it to be considerably easier at 60 kilohertz than at 5 megacycles. On top of that, I sense that the 60 kilohertz signal is considerably more reliable as to how many hours per day the signal is there above a certain signal-to-noise ratio. And I presume the 5 megacycles does completely fade out at times. You maybe want to amplify my guesses on that one, John. Also, I am guessing you are an electronic engineer with quite a number of years' experience and possibly broadcast to have the background to do this kind of work. You can confirm or deny that also. KD2VD, K2RIW in the tech.
Repeater, timeout.
Once again, John, you've got it.
Roger. K2RAW in the TechNet from KD2BD. Well, you know, if you're looking for a fairly decent standard, 1.6. It's interesting. That might affect WWD.
John, we did miss portions of that, and if you were able to increase your signal to noise ratio on future weeks, that would be helpful. I'd like to hear a lot more about what you've been telling us, and thank you for bringing that all to our attention, John. I think the next person who signed in was Bob, W2PNJ, and Robert, what would you like to discuss tonight? K2RIW. Now, Bob, go ahead.
Why?
W2PNJ, you there, Bob? K2RIW. Okay, maybe Bob got called away and maybe he'll come back later. I wonder if Paul's available tonight. WS2N, are you available, Paul?
WS2N, good evening, Dick.
Okay, glad to hear from you, Paul. And how are things going with NASA this week? And is there anything we should know about? As if I didn't know.
Okay, Dick. Well, I'm busy with ether and a few other things. Cut my trees down. So I haven't been paying much attention to the NASA details. It was a good show on the other day. I didn't get a chance to see the whole thing yet. I have it recorded on CBS. 400 years of the telescope. I got to the first 20 minutes and I got a call. Arthur, watch that again. Supposed to be very good. From the early telescopes all the way up to what they have today. And it could be interesting. There's a telescope that's on the drawing board for 2017. I'll find the name of it here. I wrote it down somewhere. But this is an interesting telescope. There's $2 billion already allocated for it. And what this thing is going to do is they'll launch it, put it 1 million miles away from Earth, similar to what they're doing with the Kepler telescope. And the idea of this one is actually photograph planets, Earth-sized planets. Now, this is down the road, like I said. What they're going to do is put up a gigantic sun shade, or let's call it a star shade, many kilometers away from the telescope that will be launched. And what the shade will do, it will block out the stars that it's looking at to photograph the planet when we drop it. This is beyond Kepler. You know, Kepler is going to look for dimming up the stars to detect Earth-sized planets. This is predicted to be able to take pictures of the planets themselves. They've experimented years ago with how they were going to do this. If you put a black shade, it's going to be made out of like the type of material you would have, like a black plastic bag that you put in your garbage can. It's that type of material. So if you were to put a square one up or a round one up, the diffused light would interfere with what they were trying to photograph. And what they're going to do is they've experimented with petal-like structures, like a flower, you know, a gigantic thing that they put out there in space in front of the telescope. And this petal-like structure when light hits that from the stars, the distant stars, it won't be diffracted like it would, with something round, or a square edge, or a straight edge. So it sounds pretty interesting, and we'll have to see what happens down the road. But again, I got to find the name of this thing. This is the speaker. They had a speaker that was talking about it. We dropped it at the ICON convention. This woman who's involved with this, some doctor who she's graduated from Arizona University of Arizona, really into astronomy. And she goes around and makes the speeches of this. This particular thing is her a baby, you know. And, they have this ICON convention every year, and this year was held at Brentwood. Brentwood, the state university over there. That's not the state, the county university. That was this last weekend. But unfortunately, I wasn't able to go. I would have had more details. But this is an interesting project that they got on the drawing board. Years from now, I hope to see something like this launched. Back to you, Dick, WS2S.
Yeah, I think, let me drop for a long enough period of time, see if anyone else wants to join us.
I'm just back. I've been called away. Sorry for that.
We took attendance. We knew you weren't here. That was a joke, Alex. Let me see if I'm going to let the machine drop and see if anyone wants to join us from the net.
WHYY. Joe.
Joe.
Checking in.
And W2OSR with a question.
Joe and Bob recognize. I'm going to let the machine drop just to make sure there's nobody trying to check in from the net. And apparently not. I think this is officially the year of astronomy, as they call it, or something like that. This is the 400th anniversary of the real beginning of the telescope. Galileo made his first measurements in 1609, and here we are 400 years later, making some really big telescope, like the overwhelmingly large telescope and whatever. And this 2017 telescope you're describing, Paul, sounds like an occulting telescope. In other words, by artificially with that flower-shaped object, you make a kind of solar eclipse, so to speak, and if you position things just right, you can block out the star that the planet you want to measure is going around. And you got to be careful not to have a sharp edge when you do that. It's got to be a serrated edge in order not to give you a specific diffraction pattern. And that is a technique that has been used a number of times with so-called compact antenna ranges, which is one of the things invented by Scientific Atlanta Company. At least that's the first time I remember seeing one. You can take an antenna range, which has to be, let's say, 1,000 feet long in order to properly measure the near-field characteristics of a particular large antenna in wavelengths, and by way of a parabolic nearby mirror, acting as a collimator from your real signal source, you can make an antenna range that electronically acts like it's 1,000 feet long, even though it might really be 30 feet long. Very crafty technique. But they have to, on that parabolic mirror that does the collimating, put a serrated edge so that the diffraction pattern around the edge of that mirror doesn't create interference with the measurement you want to make. So I'm going to pick up Joe and Bob in that order. Joe, do you have a question or a comment? W-A-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W.
Dick, I have the name and everything. Let me give you that to you this way if anybody wants to look it up on the Internet.
Go right ahead, Bob.
Dick, WS2N, I have the name of the telescope.
Roger, Dodger Bob. Go ahead and tell us the name of the 2017 telescope. And do you know how many feet in diameter it is?
We'll go back to Dr. Maggie Turnbull is the speaker for this. And it's called a New World Observer. And you're looking at a two-point, the mirror is bigger. The Hubble is 2.4 meters. This thing is much bigger than that. Give you a quick rundown. They call it the New World Observer, the NWO, 50-yard wide, daisy-shaped plastic sunshade. And I was looking for the size here. Looking for the size. I don't see it, Dick, but I'll probably come across it. We'll come. We got a lot of years to look for this. But NASA has committed $3 billion to this thing. They hope to identify oceans, continents, polar caps, cloud cover, and even detect biomarkers such as methane, oxygen, water, so, you know, if they exist, to possibly even detect life in these far distant planets. So that's the scoop on that. Back to you.
I have a question.
Go ahead with your question, Alex.
Well, this new super-duper telescope can make a picture of the footprint on the moon?
There's a yes and a no to that. Every antenna has something called near-field range, which is defined as 2d squared over lambda. D is diameter and lambda is wavelength. And if you make a measurement at a closer range than that, without creating a correcting set of spectacles, so to speak, you no longer get a coherent image out of the mirror. You may get a high-resolution picture, relatively high-resolution, but you're not going to get full performance. So making a mirror real big gives you the angular resolution you and I desire, but now can you focus it as close as the moon? Mount Palomar, under normal circumstances, I think I did the calculation one day, cannot focus on a lunar object with full resolution unless you reform the mirror into a elliptical-shaped mirror instead of a parabolic-shaped mirror. So I know you, Alex, would like to see a real hard photograph of the hardware left on the moon by the Apollo astronauts as a method of dispelling the number of people who think that the Apollo program didn't really take place, that it was actually a hoax. And even if that mirror has the ability to photograph that hardware on the moon, I'm afraid that's not going to satisfy those particular people, Alex, because those people will just say, hey, that photo is a fake. It was done with Photoshop. So I'm not convinced that that's going to be the cure to the problem. We're just going to have to talk to the people who have more direct knowledge, and I can't believe the 50,000 people of NASA allowed a hoax to take place and the story didn't leak out. So there's no doubt in my mind. Let me go over to both John and, Joe and Bob, who are waiting in the wings here. Joe, W2RYY, go ahead with your question or comment if you've got one. K2RYW in the TechNet.
I wasn't checking out a question, but I actually have a comment about frequency measurement, which might be a little easy for some people if they haven't caught it in the past couple of weeks or past months. We've talked about this before. By using these DTV carriers that are 309 kilohertz below the bottom end of the band for frequency accuracy, the only problem is knowing which stations are exactly on frequency and which is not. That might be a little bit of a problem, but that might also be an easier way, a much more reliable way to get yourself well within the measurement range of what you're looking for something in the VHF or UHF part of the spectrum, because it's a signal that's easily and readily available. It's right there in your backyard, and probably most can receive it with simple receiving equipment.
Okay, make sure the machine dropped. That sounds like a good approach, Joe, but I see a problem. If I understand correctly what John told us early, KD2BD, he is making measurements to an accuracy of 7 pods per billion. And if I understand that correctly, that's the combination of the error of the measurement he made of the signal that was being transmitted by American Radio Relay League, combined with the frequency error of his reference. The RMS combination of those two errors turned out to be 7 pods per billion. As soon as we get a chance to talk to Eric again, KE2EJ, I am relatively sure that the FCC requirements for a digital television broadcast transmission is nowhere near that degree of accuracy, 7 pods per billion. As such, it's possible that the standard broadcast digital TV doesn't have that accuracy yet, and therefore John is ahead of the game to keep using the 60 kilohertz signal from Boulder, Colorado, and WWVB. That's my first guess as to what I think is going on there. But when we get a chance to talk to John again, maybe next week, we'll get more into those details. Without a doubt, for the measurements, let me drop. For the measurements you've been making in order to correct the reference oscillator within your service monitor, your IFR or whatever brand name you were using, using standard broadcast, I think gives you more than enough accuracy for the work you desire. That's my belief. But could you get 7 pods per billion by that technique? I'm skeptical, but we'll find out from John.
Hey, Dave.
In the future. Yeah, who said that?
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, I've heard of you. Go ahead, Eric. What kind of pods per billion do you believe digital television broadcast stations, and name a couple, like the one on Channel 21, or what do you believe they're able to achieve? You got it, Eric.
If you're making a measurement today, I wouldn't use any broadcast station, because a lot of things are in flux. Some people are on GPS, some people aren't. CBS used to use a rubidium clock. I used to use a cesium clock, but that doesn't necessarily translate to the transmitter anymore because we go through so many other devices before we even get there.
Make a rough guess, if you could, Eric. What do you believe in pods per billion during this period of transition from analog into digital television? What do you believe is the approximate frequency accuracy? Give it to me in any units you like. Millihertz, hertz, pods per billion, whatever. What do you believe is the frequency accuracy approximately that is being achieved today? Over to you, Eric.
All right, well, there's one thing if you're talking about digital transmission, you got to figure out whether you're on an N or an N plus 1. If you're an N plus 1, I don't remember the number right off the top of my head, but it's like a 6-digit offset number. So it's not exactly on channel, it's spaced off a little bit, but as far as frequency stability, it's plus or minus 10 hertz.
Okay, plus or minus 10 hertz, I'm just going to round things off. I know you guys are not up at a gigahertz, but a gigahertz would be one pod per billion. Is that right? Yeah, one pod per billion. And 10 hertz is going to be 10 pods per billion. And since you're really at half a gig and not one gig, it equates to around 20 pods per billion is 20 hertz at a UHF frequency. Very rough numbers. And from what I'm hearing, John is getting considerably better than that. With his reference oscillator error, RMS, with his frequency measurement error, he's getting numbers like 7 pods per billion. So he's quite far ahead of the game of what you and I can muster right now. He's way ahead of us, Eric. We're going to have to work to catch up. Hey, Bob, what would you like to know about all this jazz? W2OSR. Mr. Secretary, K2RIW.
Oh, by the way, I have 2 cesium clocks.
Okay. Sounds like you've got the technology, and once you start deploying it, you're going to get there. You got it, Bob.
Okay, Dick. Good evening, W2OSR. Question. I talked to you about that 2-meter antenna I'm working on. Now I'm getting to the point where I'm trying to figure out how to match it. And what I'm looking at is an impedance of about 12 ohms on the driven element. And I'm just looking for what you think would be the best way in which to match the antenna to a 50-ohm coax.
Okay. First of all, Bob, your audio is about 10 decibels lower than it should be. Good, clean audio, lots of RF, but your audio is quite low. Now, as I've indicated a number of times before, there is an article that you might want to consider on how to get a perfect frequency match to the driven element of any Yagi. The article was written by K2RIW, It appears on a website. If you go to the website of WA1MBA, Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Bravo Alpha, .com, .net, .org, I think it's .org. Anyhow, you'll find it real fast. Dr. Williams, Dr. Tom Williams, you go to his microwave website. At the bottom of the first page, you'll see impedance matching of Yagi's by K2RIW. And once you open up that article, it tells you the methodology of getting a perfect impedance match, resistive and reactive component, by using a technique that when I published that article in the United Kingdom, when I published that article in Australia and New Zealand, they jump up and down with enthusiasm and say, why the hell hasn't somebody told me this secret earlier? But except for that website, I can't get that article published in the United States because everyone thinks that impedance matching of a Yagi is of the driven element is so old-fashioned and boring that nobody wants to publish it. So you've got the secret information in the United States here, Bob, when you go to that website. And what it basically does, I'm going to give you a quick thumbnail sketch of it. Stand by. I heard an extremely weak signal in there, which I was not able to identify. And on the next transmission, I'll drop long enough to give that person an opportunity. When you look at the so-called Brown and Woodward curves, which are in Chapter 4 of all of the last three editions of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, it's diagram 4-3 and 4-4. And in the very first edition, it was in Chapter 3 instead of Chapter 4. When you look at that set of curves, what Brown and Woodward did way back in 1946 is they spent a man year, in my opinion, measuring every possible diameter of a dipole slash monopole and every possible length and what is the exact resistive impedance and reactive impedance do you get. Well, I looked at those curves and I said, wow, I see a correlation. Whenever you make the dipole longer, the impedance gets higher, period. The resistive component gets higher. Make it shorter, the resistive component gets lower. So by starting off with a half-wave dipole and make it longer and shorter, I can give any resistive component you want, from 1 ohm to more than 1,000 ohms, by doing nothing but changing the length. Doesn't matter if you're feeding it in a delta match, a gamma match, direct feeding, folded dipole, whatever. From wherever you start, you can make the impedance go up or down by doing nothing but adjusting the length. And when you adjust the length of the driven element of a Yagi, you are not changing the gain characteristics, the directivity characteristics of the Yagi. You're doing nothing but changing the impedance match of the driven element. That's all you want to do. However, once you choose the right length that gives you the exact resistive component you want, in your case you want to step 12 ohms up to 50, that's easy. I'm going to guess that it's about a 10% increase in length and you're there. But there will be some inductive reactants left over when you go longer than half wave electronically. All you have to do then is put a shunt capacitor across your feeding network and you're there. There's a little bit of interaction. But when you read that article, it's 1,500 words telling you exactly how to do it. Should I repeat that website? At WA1WhiskeyAlpha1MikeBravoAlpha.org, Dr. Tom Williams, first page, you'll find an article that will tell you exactly how to do it with the curve supplied. You don't even have to go out and buy the reference data for radio
repeater. Time out.
You don't even have to buy the reference data for radio engineers. You'll be there. You need to fill in that, Bob. W2OSR, K2RIW.
Here comes Jan Kurtz again.
K2RIW, W2OSR. We'll give Alex a chance there in a minute. I'm on that web page right now, Dick, and I can't find the article, so I may be a little help as to what it was actually called.
Did you go to the bottom of the first page?
I am at the very bottom. Oh, Yagi impedance matching info. Element length for the junior boomer.
That's it. Open up that section and tell me what you see.
I see a photograph of Dr. Yagi and information from K2RIW.
You have arrived. And I'm going to give you a pop quiz the next time you and I talk, see how much you absorbed of that article. You've got the secret, Bob. They refused to publish it in the United States. You've got the secret. I hope you feel sufficiently honored. That's a joke.
Okay, Dick. I'll let you get back to the other fellows on the net. Thank you. 73W2OSR.
What's the website, Dick? Website is WhiskeyAlpha1, MikeBravoAlpha.org. It's the microwave site of Dr. Tom Williams. At the bottom of the page, you'll find the information that allows you to get a perfect, and I mean perfect, a perfect impedance match of any driven element of any dipole or Yagi you are ever going to touch for the rest of your life. Over to you, Eric, for any fill on that.
I'm just going to read it. You continue.
Okay, I'm going to give you a pop quiz also. Okay, Mr. Yonkers, N2NNU, what would you like to know about all this?
Well, I can see what you're saying there. However, shortening or lengthening the driven element, I have a feeling it will change its resonance point too, so it might be off frequency when you deploy that. But I can see a solution to that. You use an asymmetric... oh gosh, I'm thinking on three planes here. You leave the element length the same, but you're changing the ratio between the left and the right, and that will adjust also the impedance.
Kilo 2N.
Kilo 2N, I think it was. Kilo 2N. We'll get to you in a minute. Alex, you're absolutely right. An off-center fed driven element, off-center fed dipole, is another method of raising the impedance. However, if you're feeding a dipole in your backyard on, let's say, 80 meters, and you decide to off-center feed it to get your desired resistive component impedance and resonance simultaneously, you have to supply a good balancing device so that you get a common mode impedance rejection. In other words, you need a current balance, which is a bit of an unusual device for most of us to build. And if you did that on a Yagi structure, the asymmetric feeding will give you a little bit of skew of pattern, a little bit of what they call squint. So therefore, I'm not a strong recommender of off-center feeding of the driven element of a Yagi. But when you do follow this suggestion of mine, which I've now done, I won't say thousands of times, but I've done it hundreds of times in my consulting business, and I have on multiple occasions achieved better than -35 dB of reflection coefficient, which is something like a 1.02 standing wave ratio. Yes, when you change the length, you appear to be changing the resonant frequency. But changing the length makes the resistive component what you want. But it leaves you a reactive component left over, usually inductive. When you shunt that with a capacitor right at the feed terminals, and you cancel all reactants, and all reactants goes to zero, and the resistance is the right component you desire, by definition, that is the new resonant frequency on exactly the frequency you're operating on. One of the definitions of resonance is there is no reactive component left in the impedance. So the longer physical length to get the right resistive component, followed by the shunt capacitor to get rid of the reactants, makes that assembly called driven element center-fed, symmetrically fed, exactly the impedance you want, exactly resonant where you want it. There's no problem left. Let me drop. I got another comment on this one. Now, many of... like I'm going to have to use the other input frequency. Okay. Many of us have cut off our teeth on the concept that when you adjust the length of a driven element, you are changing the directivity characteristic of the Yagi. Many people believe that. It's an old wives' tale. Absolutely not true. Simultaneously, many people have come to believe that if the driven element is not shorter than the reflector, or correspondingly, if the reflector is not longer, that you don't have a Yagi anymore. Absolutely not true. All that the driven element of a Yagi is required to do is radiate in a dipole-like manner, give you a good impedance match to your particular transmission line, and to also give you no common mode current flowing down the outside of the transmission line. Once you do that, the rest of the Yagi will perform. The fact that you might be forced into making the driven element a little bit longer than the reflector in the process of doing that makes people think that the antenna is going to explode and terrible things are going to happen and it's not a Yagi anymore. I can tell you from hands-on experience that when you do this, the directivity pattern, the gain of the antenna does not change. You're only adjusting the driven element impedance match. Now, there are Yagi users of great intelligence and lots of experience, moon bouncers out there, who I've given this advice to. They started lengthening the driven element to the point where they were getting a better impedance match. They were simultaneously measuring the gain and pattern. They all stayed exactly where they wanted to get. The impedance match was getting better, but at the instant the driven element began to exceed the length of the reflector, they stopped. They would not go a millimeter beyond that point. And I had multiple conversations back and forth, particularly a particular guy in Holland on this particular subject. He would not go that next millimeter. He assumed the antenna would explode if he did that. Amazing to me. He could see no detriment happen. He could see nothing but benefit happening, and he refused to go that last millimeter. It just shows you how sometimes how strong our beliefs can become based on what we think is multiple years of experience of a particular antenna type. Anybody with any further questions or comments on this, give me your call letters, K2RIW.
K2RIW.
And me again.
Okay, I heard KE2EJ and W02N in that order. EJ first, go ahead.
Yeah, just a curiosity. When people are actually adjusting the length, do they take of the, not the driven element, but the parasitic element, do they take different lengths of, say, wire or whatever it is that they're using? Because I'm just thinking about you could actually take two pieces of tubing, one a little bit smaller than the other, and make a fairly interesting adjustable length to each element. But then you have to, of course, measure and make sure it's balanced on both sides. But what do people normally do when they're actually tuning? Whether they just simply start too long and try to cut it down?
Okay, first of all, when you change the diameter of the driven element of a Yagi, in a very slow process, you're changing the driven element impedance. Very slow. And if you are feeding it in a folded dipole-like manner, and you make two different diameters, one diameter for the dipole itself and another diameter for the folded dipole structure, you can get some additional impedance matching with that technique. But it's very slow, very difficult, and you cannot really get the tuning I'm talking about. What I am suggesting is that a person starts off with whatever driven element he's already got. He can easily lengthen it electronically by putting telescoping pieces of tubing at the tips, and the fact that those are slightly larger in diameter, don't worry about it. He can put pieces of copper tape temporarily at the tips, making it top hat capacitors on the ends. Electronically, there's a zillion ways you can lengthen the driven element. You can put a choke in the center, you know, a loading coil. You can put top hat capacitors. You can put sliding pieces of telescoping tubing. And don't worry about the conductivity of the telescoping pieces of tubing. The impedance out of the tip is so high, you would have difficulty making it a bad contact. You're up to a 2,000 ohm impedance out there, if you know what I mean. So making it longer is very easy. And it doesn't have to be something where you plan it ahead of time and make the driven element super long to begin with. Build it as recommended by the original design. Start off with your original design, and electrically lengthening doesn't matter. Once you do this lengthening so that the resistive component becomes exactly 50.00 ohms, if that's what you desire, and you've got some inductance left over, temporarily you put a shunt capacitor across that feed point, right at the center, whatever your feed point is, where it joins your transmission line. Let me drop. Temporarily, you put a capacitor there in a very simple manner. You put a piece of paper tape across one of the terminals. On the other terminal, you take a piece of copper tape, wrap it across the two terminals. One of them is insulated, one of them is not insulated. And with a long piece of wooden rod, you stand off to one side, and you poke that piece of copper tape until you get the right capacitance. All you're trying to prove here is that you can get a perfect impedance match to that antenna. Once you get it, to convert your gimmick capacitors on the tips of the elements or at the driven element center conductor, to convert your gimmick capacitors into more stable, transmitting rated things that are weatherproofed. That's easy. You just first want to prove you can do it and that it works and it gives you the gain and the impedance that you want. And if you've got any gain, directivity, front-to-back ratio, pattern, impedance match, efficiency, the whole works. You can measure it all. If you have any doubt about the efficiency of your antenna, all you've got to do is put 100 watts into it for a couple of minutes, turn off the transmitter, walk over there and touch everything and find out if anything got warm. That's the only way you can waste power, is by something getting warm. If everything is cold, you've arrived. A hand can easily detect 1 watt of dissipation for a couple of minutes. 1 watt out of 100 watts is something like 0.05 dB of loss. It's an extremely sensitive test of antenna efficiency. You might have some questions or comments on that, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
So, in essence, you could take the capacitor and where you tap it in along the driven element, and sort of like is what I see in terms of some Yagis with a gamma match on it, it's actually adjustable. So, in essence, you're looking for that perfect match there. But now, in relationship to gain, how much effect do the directors and reflectors have? How much of an effect do they have on that match when you adjust those particular lengths?
Yeah, I think I see where you're going here. In the case of a gamma match, the gamma rod itself has a series capacitor that with some difficulty you can adjust the magnitude of the series capacitor, usually by telescoping pieces of tubing in that area with an intermediate insulating device, dielectric. And you can also adjust the resistive component by adjusting where the metal clip of the gamma rod touches the one hand of the driven element. I'm not a strong enthusiast of gamma rods. The nice news about them is that they're easily tunable and fairly easy to construct. The slight disadvantage is it's a slightly non-symmetric method of feeding the driven element. I'm much more in favor of pure folded dipole feed. And the capacitor I'm talking about is not a series capacitor, it's a shunt capacitor. I will admit that the shunt capacitor, when you put it in, is capable of giving you a perfect impedance match, but there is some interaction between the length adjustment and the capacitor in the center adjustment. But it only takes you 3 minutes to do it if you've got the right instrumentation, so that the fact that there's interaction between the two, the fact that you're doing it in a shunt manner, is minor. Now, what a Yagi is a series of parasitic elements where each individual parasitic element has a particular resonant frequency. The reflector happens to be tuned to a lower frequency. The directors happen to be tuned to a series of higher frequencies. But it's a series of reactances, it's a series of parasitic elements with each of their in tune frequency. Because they're tuned to a particular frequency, because they have a particular diameter, they create a particular amount of reactance in space. The directors are all capacitive, they're a slow wave structure. The driven element of the reflector is a longer structure, it's inductive. And it happens to be a fast wave structure, so to speak. So the Yagi is a series of reactances at a position in space for each one of those reactances. Whether you make the elements fat, skinny, long, short, whatever, as long as each one of those parasitic elements has the right amount of reactance at that point in space, then you have a Yagi. It gives you the directed pattern you want. The driven element only has to radiate in a dipole-like manner to set all of that into motion. The exact length of the driven element doesn't matter, within reason. You make the element two wavelengths long, and yes, now you're radiating some of the signal out of the
repeater. Time out.
You make that driven element two wavelengths long, and now you're radiating some of the energy out of the field of the parasitic element. So that's a ridiculous structure, although even I even mentioned that in the article. So within reason, you're only making a few percent change in the length. There's nothing magic about the exact physical length of that driven element. Make it whatever physical length you want so that it has the right resistive component you want. Get rid of the reactive component with a simple shunt capacitor, and you're there. As long as you didn't disturb the rest of the Yagi, you left all the parasitic elements alone, you have not changed the gain, you have not changed the front-to-back ratio, you have not changed the directivity pattern. All you've done is properly impedance match the driven element, and there's a great motivation for doing that. If you're using a really good low noise amplifier, which you have carefully tuned on a automatic noise figure indicator, which has 50.0 ohms of impedance, and you've adjusted your gas-fed amplifier to give you the best performance from that particular source, that then should give you strong motivation to make sure that your antenna-driven element also has exactly 50.0 ohms of resistive impedance so that your LNA gives you the same performance. One of the well-kept secrets is that if you take a well-tuned, high-performance LNA for moon-bounce performance and you feed it into some other impedance other than 50.0 ohms resistive, like water droplets on your antenna on a rainy day changing impedance, your LNA has a brand new noise figure that you're not going to be happy with. I'll admit it's not a huge crashing of performance. Your 0.35 dB noise figure maybe goes to 1.35. It's not the end of the world.